This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Jason Reza Giorgiani and Francis Nally. We're going to be discussing Jason's Promethean platform and going more into in-depth about the Prometheist philosophy. Jason, it's great having you back on the show, and also Francis Nally.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Robert. Great to be with you again, Francis, as well.
Nice. Hey, guys. Nice to be here.
And Jason and I, there's a video out on Stark Truth TV. This is an in-person interview with Jason that we filmed in person in L.A. several months ago. To revisit the Promethean archetype, Prometheus means to think ahead, and how Prometheus, as a rebel against his fellow Titans on behalf of the Olympians, against Zeus, and the Prometheus from Greek mythology, rebelling against tyranny for the sake of man. Jason, you would say that the core principles of the foundation of Promethean philosophy, you would say, is it beauty, justice, and truth?
No, I'd be very cautious about putting it that way. Let me back up for a minute and make a comment in response to your description of Prometheus as a rebel on behalf of the Olympians and a champion of humanity. Okay, so Prometheus is, of course, a Titan. He is not one of the Olympian gods. And before Prometheus rebels against the authority of Zeus as an advocate of humanity, Prometheus rebels against his fellow Titans. He helps Zeus come to power by defeating Cronos. So, which is, interestingly, is the god of time. And so there's an issue there that has to do with Prometheus being the deity of forethought and his helping Zeus to overcome Cronos, the lord of eternal time, which is a fatalistic notion of temporality. So the thing about Prometheus is that although he is a Titan, he rebels both against his fellow Titans and then later also against the Olympians as a champion of humanity. So in a sense, although Prometheus is from a class of beings that far predates humanity, that is far more primordial than humanity, temporally speaking, and a race of beings that engenders humanity, Prometheus is in some sense actually an epitome of humanity. He is the most humanistic deity that one can identify, I think, in any of the comparative mythologies of the world. So, you know, we're not really dealing with a Titan here or someone who's been incorporated into the Olympian pantheon. We're dealing with a deity who defies both the gods and the Titans, and this whole binary of the battle between these two classes of beings that you can find in both branches of the Indo-European tradition, both the European branch going back to the Greeks and also the Indo-Iranian branch. So Prometheus really defies that dichotomy as a deity who epitomizes the human spirit and is tasked with protecting humanity.
So as far as the degree of free will, what is the prerequisite of being personally accountable for meaningful actions? That, forget if that was the subject matter of the Promethean platform where you kind of explain the philosophy. So do you reject that view that actions are predetermined, and then thoughts on resistance to any authority that is perceived to be arbitrary or illegitimate, the rebellious nature of the Promethean ethos, and then just kind of your overall thoughts on what are the core principles of Promethean philosophy. Would you say is beauty, justice, and truth, is that those are core principles, or that's overly simplistic?
It's overly simplistic, and I'll come back to it. Let me begin with free will. And here I think maybe an opportunity to kind of address some of the points that were made by Roman Daspermont, who is the author of a book called The Promethean Right. You recently had a dialogue with him in which he drew some stark contrast between his thought and mine. And one of them, which I found quite shocking, was that he claimed not to believe in free will. And in fact, he made the statement that he doesn't think it's even logically coherent to conceive of something between total randomness and thorough determinism. And by way of answering your question about free will, I'd say that Roman's notion of logical consistency is problematic. It has in its background the idea that the cosmos could have a completed logical structure. So his metric, his standard for what's logically coherent, presupposes this thoroughly integrated, fully self-consistent, and complete logical structure in the cosmos, going both backwards and forwards into time, right? So this is what physicists call the block universe. And I would say that for there to be free will, and by extension, any meaningful creativity, you need a cosmos that's logically incomplete, where there is no logically completed structure that could even in principle be surveyed by an omniscient and an omnipotent being, right? So, I mean, first of all, in a logically incomplete cosmos, in a cosmos where, you know, there's work still to be done and creation is incomplete, you wouldn't have an omnipotent, but you know, and an omniscient being in the first place, right? Because such a being would be coextensive with the entire cosmos, you know, eternally. But let's just hypothetically say, right, that you have this omniscient and omnipotent being. That being should not be able to survey all the future configurations of entities in the cosmos, right? So. Nor should that being be able to manipulate the cosmos in a way that divests any particular entity of its role in co-constituting the world. And so, you know, I don't think there's any empirical reason to presuppose that the cosmos does have this logically completed structure. This is a transcendental postulation. In other words, It's an abstract projection onto the cosmos. And I won't say I don't know why someone would think that way. Someone would think that way because they want, you know, a sense of fundamental certainty. But I think it's a real misplacement of priorities. You should not deny free will based on an abstract postulate for which there is no empirical evidence and without which you can continue to do empirical science with no problem whatsoever, right? I mean, this kind of notion of a logically completed cosmos is not at all necessary for carrying out empirical science. And if you postulate it, you are actually reducing scientific praxis to absurdity, because scientists are also human beings, and the very structure of thought is radically intentional. Thought itself makes no sense without intentionality. So, you know, free will isn't just a question of overt actions in the world, like, you know, picking up a pen that's next to you. Even pursuing a coherent train of thought is, on some level, an intentional action. And so the whole scientific enterprise is reduced to absurdity by denying free will. Roman, in particular, when he was talking about how he is concerned that any putative artificial intelligence might be super smart, but it might actually lack consciousness. And if we fuse ourselves with such an AI, we're in danger of losing our consciousness. When he was making those remarks, I think he was running into a self-contradiction. He was contradicting himself, because why be so concerned about us losing our consciousness if we have no free will? Consciousness is inconceivable without free will. And I think, frankly, anybody in the history of philosophy who has tried to maintain that there's a substantive phenomenon known as consciousness, which is not merely epiphenomenal, you know, which is not reducible to matter and material configurations, and this is what he claims as an idealist, he claims that there's a robust phenomenon of consciousness. Such a person is contradicting themselves if they deny free will. The other thing that I noticed is that, you know, he puts a lot of emphasis on the will to create, and of course that's very Promethean. In fact, he thinks that, you know, we will be able to create universes inside laboratories, and he's concerned with whether these will be universes that function according to the kind of laws that our universe functions, namely competitive universes. He describes it as an almost fascistic universe that we live in, with the kind of brutal...
So do you think that theory is scientifically viable, or your disagreement is more philosophical?
Look, I actually have a lot of doubt about whether such a thing is scientifically viable, but that's not my point right now. My point right now is, let's just suppose that it is scientifically viable. Why are you even concerned about the will to create various universes where you think that we lack will? I mean, he doesn't think we have a will. Okay, there's no meaningful sense of will where you don't have some degree of self-determination. Anyone who's argued that doesn't know what they're talking about. Will means some degree of self-determination. And then furthermore, when you say create universes, and he conceives of this as the ultimate work of art, well, creation absolutely requires self-determination and self-responsibility and intentionality. So if we don't have free will, we can't create anything, let alone, you know, one or another type of universe. So I think there's a self-contradiction there. And it also, you know, aside from the fact that it's fundamentally incoherent, it really is at odds with the Promethean mentality at its foundation, because the whole idea of the Promethean presupposes rebellion against tyranny and innovation. And, you know, these two fundamental qualities of the Promethean require freedom and the fostering and commit themselves to the fostering of freedom. So those are a couple of problems that I have with, you know, the remarks that he was making in your conversation with him. And there are a couple of other points that I could raise maybe later on. But that was by way of answering your question about free will. And then, you know, let me comment on that. And then we can get to the question about truth, beauty, and justice, and, you know, what the Prometheus view on these fundamental facets of the philosophical enterprise is.
So there is like a philosophy of creativity, the inspirational power of beauty as an expression, I guess the view that it's expression of an evolutionary force, and there certainly are perceived limitations in regards to the face. There are like perceived limitations on what can be accomplished as far as the work of the aesthetics and arts, and also technological innovation. So what does Prometheism offer as inspiration, as the fountainhead of creativity, the sort of the Faustian, relevant to the Faustian in that it's perpetual industrious innovation, as opposed to society where that's culturally or technologically stagnant, like boundless creativity or radical creativity, that is the ideal? And so what would you say is the importance of philosophy as a framework for creativity, and how it relates to that concept of truth, justice, and beauty?
Yes. So I don't even want to call it a worldview. The position that I'm taking with Prometheism is one that deconstructs the representational conception of truth. It forwards Heidegger and Nietzsche's critique of the representational conception of truth. So this conception is the idea that there is an objective structure to reality, and that our minds, which are in some sense separate from the physical world, can be refined in their perception and their cognition so that we can mirror the objective structure of reality in the knowledge that that our minds possess. So our knowledge, through various theoretical structures and through empirical research, winds up being a more or less adequate mirror to objective reality. And this is an idea that culminated with the advent of the Cartesian paradigm, but you can see it in an incipient form even in Plato. Platonic idealism presupposes something like this, particularly when you look at texts like the Timaeus. So I reject this idea and deconstruct it, and I radicalize the Nietzschean and Heideggerian critique of this idea in a way that also incorporates insights from Buddhist thought. So I think that infinite creativity, which is something that I affirm and that I think is at the core of the Promethean project, infinite creativity is only possible if the cosmos is an order emerging from out of chaos. And what I mean there by chaos is not reducible to the kind of fractal mathematics that's described by chaos theory, although I think that the development of such fractal structures could not take place but for this more primordial chaos, right? So how I conceive of this chaos is very much along the lines of what Buddhist thinkers like Nishitani and Nishida mean by shunyata. So the shunyata idea is that there is a mathematically ungraspable abyssal dimension of existence. You could call it the background of existence, what Heidegger called the Abgrund, the background of all entities. And so it is a no-thingness in a quite literal sense. The being of all things depends on it, but it itself is no thing. And so it's inexhaustible and unfathomable. And only when you presuppose this kind of chaos as a background to the cosmos, do you have a wellspring for an unfathomable wellspring for infinite creativity. And so, by the way, this is another area where I had a problem with Roman's critiques of my position, because he seems to think that I'm a Gnostic, and I'm certainly not a Gnostic on an ontological level. I totally reject Gnostic dualism, and my ontology is actually, in a way, much closer to that of Buddhism. Although I think that that kind of nothingness, shunyata, or what Heidegger called Abgrund, should be seen not as a voidness that one wants to assimilate oneself to through deconstructing oneself, but a kind of nothingness that provides this seething wellspring for the infinitely novel elaboration of new structures. And see, if that weren't true ontologically, then you would run out of possible configurations. You would run out of possible configurations in the cosmos and possible configurations of various innovations, whether in terms of technology or the arts, right? I mean, if you postulate a finite cosmos and an eternal time frame, you're going to run out of possible configurations of things. The only way you get out of that is that you have to presuppose as a background to the finite cosmos, to one or another finite universe, an unfathomable, an infinite background, infinite in the sense of being unfathomable and abyssal. And so that this this limitless energy can be reshaped in indefinitely novel ways forward into the future, right? So that means that the Promethean conception of truth is very different from this representational notion that there's an objective truth and that it's our task to be able to ascertain it with our, you know, cognition. So that's in terms of truth. And then its connection to beauty, of course, I already implied, which is that if you presuppose some objectively existent and unchanging reality, then it's going to be the case that there is a perfect aesthetic, that there is something that you're going to eventually happen upon after, you know, a certain very long period of social development. You're going to happen upon the perfect aesthetic, a form of architecture, a type of painting, a style of painting, and so forth, that is perfectly beautiful. Because based on the representational conception of truth, there is also a certain aesthetic harmony and proportionality, like in terms of, you know, the Fibonacci ratios and so forth, that would be the necessary culmination of any trajectory of aesthetic development. And that's a notion that, you know, obviously I also reject. I think that there are, you know, indefinitely many forms that art could take forward into the future, and that beauty is really about maximizing creativity and overcoming bottlenecks in social and cultural development. So, you know, beauty doesn't lie in any particular style of architecture or any particular form of painting, you know, or and so forth, or any particular type of literary expression. Beauty is expressed most poignantly and in the most awe-inspiring way at those moments where a bottleneck or a seeming dead end is broken through, and you have a new dynamic trajectory of development take place. I think that's really the expression of beauty. And then finally, just to touch on justice, I think that the Promethean rebellion against tyranny is a rebellion precisely against these fixed notions of the beautiful and this representational idea of truth. So there are political regimes that will follow from the representational notion of truth, right? I mean, the Hindu caste system, for example, is based on something like this representational idea of truth. The Brahman notion is in some ways very similar to Platonic idealism. And so, you know, there's going to be a whole not just political structure, but a socio-cultural formation that arises from out of this conviction that the human mind has ascertained an understanding of the ultimate nature of reality. And, you know, probably, and I think there's some empirical evidence for this that we could go into, depending on where you want to go from here, but I think probably a society like that would have an extremely geometric and mathematical type of architecture, having convinced itself that it had understood the fundamental structure of the cosmos and that it was mirroring the macrocosmic structure in the microcosm of its society. I think the political system of such a society would be totalitarian in the worst way, and that justice, in the worldview of Prometheism, is a rebellion against the delusion of that type of society.
So yeah, there's a question of like the role that aesthetics play in culture and society, and how it relates to politics and philosophy, and creating something like what is a Promethean aesthetic, creating something that is awe-inspiring. There's so many different components to go into. Like,
let me interject something, Robert. It has to be awe-inspiring in a way that fosters the human potential. When you stand in front of the oldest structures in ancient Egypt, or stand at the center of Tiwanaku in Bolivia, that's certainly an awe-inspiring experience for us, okay? Especially coming from out of the modern aesthetic context that we are, it's awe-inspiring to be surrounded by those titanic structures. But that kind of awe is meant to diminish the human individual and bring him into conformity with an inhuman, putatively objective structure that's seen as intrinsic to the cosmos. Okay, so I think the Promethean notion of aesthetic cultivation, not to say aesthetic perfection, the Promethean notion of infinitely more creative aesthetic cultivation is inconsistent with that kind of awesome architecture that diminishes the human individual. An important point.
Yeah, the impact of architecture on the psyche. So those are kind of examples of those monuments from the past that project power, but in an authoritarian sense, but at the same time are awe-inspiring, and then that some aesthetics could possibly, some like urbanism or architecture could be designed purposely to be demoralizing, and then all these different kind of debates, like there's a theory kind of associated with Oscar Wilde aestheticism, and then the contrasting that with the leftist view of aesthetics, kind of beauty relativism, and the kind of, it's a bit cliche, but I think it's still valid, like the kind of rights critique that the left, in some cases, openly celebrates something that would be considered ugly. But then you also give kind of an example of, I forget which essay this was, but I think it may be the one on the Promethean platform. So you give an example of brutalism in architecture, and which is something that traditionalist types dislike, like what it symbolizes. In the same way, you make a comparison to like industrial techno music, what it positively reflects about the technological scientific forces, but also the aesthetic value in it. So I guess the quote from, so Hugh Ferris, he was illustrator from the Art Deco era, is kind of Art Deco retrofuturism, but he characterized it as power in buildings, and going back to that theme, when it was like, it was from an era where there was immense technological progress, and also comparisons to Frank Lloyd Wright and his vision for archaeo-futurist architecture. So the kind of, yeah, like the philosophy of what aesthetics means for a society and how rigid it should be. And then I guess one comparison is relevant to Prometheus aesthetics. So your overall thoughts on that, and then what are your thoughts on the BLM statue at Rockefeller Center? And you compare it to a version, go as far as actually saying, I think like most people, or a lot of people are saying that it was just kind of an ugly statue, or focusing on the political angle, but you go as far as actually to compare that to a version of Zeus that desecrates the Promethean aesthetics of that, of Rockefeller Center. So just your overall thoughts on those points about the role of aesthetics from a philosophical standpoint.
Right. Let's back up to the beginning of your remarks and take this, step by step. So first of all, let me make a point that is going to really rub traditionalists the wrong way. They think that they hate brutalism. But let me tell you something. Their worldview will lead to the most absolute form of brutalist architecture that's conceivable. If you look at Tiwanaku, or the Osirian at Abydos in Egypt. These buildings that are older than Egyptian civilization, this has been demonstrated geologically. These structures are thousands of years older than ancient Egyptian civilization. They're Atlantean in origin. We can go back and discuss that, in another side conversation if you want, or you know, in another interview altogether. But my point is this, that there is a strange convergence between brutalism and what I call Atlantean architecture, these very streamlined, totally anonymous, geometric, jigsaw puzzled, megalithic structures in Egypt and in South America, and there are also some in other places in the world. The type of consciousness that produced that architecture is on the same trajectory as brutalism, and it's, you know, they're both motivated by the idea that there is a culmination that you can reach in aesthetic development. So brutalism is not postmodern precisely because it adheres to this modern idea that you could strip away, you know, all of the frills and the decorative elements and motifs of various previous styles of architecture, and any extraneous expressions of human personality that would be particular to one or another culture, and you could arrive at a perfectly geometric and ultimately functional architectural structure. So that's brutalism. And, you know, frankly, that's the basis for Atlantean architecture as well. It's actually a more evolved form of brutalism and equally titanic in the effect that it has on the viewer. Titanic not in the positive sense of the Promethean. And again, remember, now this is, again, I want to drive this point in right now once more, that Prometheus is not about the Titanic. Prometheus rebelled against the Titans before he rebelled against the Olympians, okay? So brutalism and Atlantean architecture are titanic in a negative sense, in the sense that diminishes human individuality and that wants to bring the human being in conformity with a presupposed cosmic order that's implacable. And so oddly enough, I mean, these traditionalists, these traditionalists will eventually come around to loving brutalism, and they're going to produce the most brutalist architecture that there's ever been if they're allowed to determine the shape of the world order. Now, Hugh Ferris is a different story. You brought up Hugh Ferris.
Yeah, I guess to make the distinction, that's actually from, I should have clarified that more in depth, but Hugh Ferris was from the Art Deco era, like the 20s and 30s, and Brutalism's more 60s and 70s, so there's a major distinction.
Yeah, so, there is a sense of force and a towering scale and massiveness to Hugh Ferris architectural drafts that is in some ways similar to brutalism. But as you said, the Art Deco, in other words, decorative features of Ferris's architecture make it a phenomenon fundamentally distinct from brutalism. And I think it's legitimate to say that Hugh Ferris's drawings are very Promethean in spirit, and perhaps Frank Lloyd Wright's work is even more Promethean. I think that, you know, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about fostering the development of the human individual and attempting to elaborate new structures and, you know, to basically... basically be capable of infinite permutations of form. And so I think there's definitely something novel that's going on in both the work of Hugh Ferris and in that of Frank Lloyd Wright, the kind of genius that you see in Wright's designs for various buildings is really unique. I mean, it's, you know, we can attribute it to a certain personality who's been shaped by a particular time and place, and you know, his work is the expression of his human personality. That's not the case with brutalism. Brutalist buildings are a kind of architectural structure that, you know, I could imagine evolving even on planets other than ours with a completely different trajectory of social development, provided that their social development wound up at the same bottleneck of being convinced that it had achieved perfection, and that the people drafting these buildings had somehow, you know, cognized the ultimate, you know, structure of the cosmos, and that they were trying to reflect it, you know, in the microcosm of their society. So those are some distinctions that I would draw between the various types of architecture and you know, that you you were mentioning. And then finally, in response to your question about the African or Neo-African sculpture of Zeus at Rockefeller Center, I would say, yeah, it's not just that the thing is terribly ugly and in bad taste, even when you look at it from an African perspective.
Yeah, even like a lot of like black nationalist types hated it.
I would be appalled if I were an African to see that sculpture. I think it's terribly insulting. In any case, it's not just a question of it's being a monstrosity. I mean, a huge scale-wise, it blocks the entire plaza. When you stand in front of it, you can't see Prometheus anymore. It blocks the entire plaza. It's the first thing you see, and it blocks out everything else at Rockefeller Center, okay? So it's an eyesore in that sense. But it's not just a question of being an ugly sculpture that is an eyesore in terms of the structure of the plaza. The fact that they took the flame of Prometheus and put it in the hand of a figure who's supposed to be Zeus enthroned, wearing an African mask, is the worst desecration of this temple to Prometheus that's imaginable. The plaza at Rockefeller Center is a temple to Prometheus, with the inscription from Aeschylus over the statue of Prometheus. And so this place is supposed to be, you know, an ode to the Promethean spirit. Ayn Rand loved it for that reason. And the idea that you're going to take the flame of Prometheus, not just you're going to build a huge statue of Zeus that blocks out Prometheus, but you're going to take the flame of Prometheus and put it in the hands of this tyrannical overlord that Prometheus helped humanity to resist, that's a desecration. And finally, that you would make this Zeus African, or rather that you would put an African mask on Zeus, basically means that blacks want to destroy the Promethean. It means that blacks want to steal the fire of liberation back from Prometheus, and they want to use it to create a tyrannical system where I suppose whites will be enslaved, or where everyone will be enslaved. It turns the African into the African mask into an endorsement of tyrannical slavery. That's what that statue is about. It's you know, absolutely disgusting, and it's a desecration that's unforgivable.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see like where these architectural aesthetic trends are going from a philosophical standpoint, because we talked about Art Deco of the like, 20s and 30s, and then from there, Brutalism came later, and then kind of postmodernism of the 80s sort of paid homage to past genres, and then I think in the 2010s, like there was this really embrace of the minimalistic aesthetic. That was mostly like a lot of these new mall, like shopping complexes or office complexes that went up in the 2010s. They're just all, everything is all gray and all glass and extremely minimalistic and these kind of like big kind of light airy spaces. So would you interpret that aesthetic as a sense concealing power and inequality rather than projecting power? Like, what is your overall take on the current aesthetic trends and especially the minimalism of the 2010s?
You know, I think it's a variegated phenomenon. There's a lot of variety in this period aesthetically. So I'm not sure that your characterization encompasses, you know, the full variety of the kind of aesthetics that we're seeing. Because, for example, in New York City, I'm very glad to see that there's a comeback of a kind of neo Art Deco style in constructing skyscrapers.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I've seen a lot of that. Even in LA. So I'm talking about a very specific genre, but you're right. It is kind of, you do see some of these neo-deco type skyscrapers proposed. So you do see both.
Well, it's more like the Leo building, right? On the 52nd Street, where it looks like a Jenga building. I don't know if that's Art Deco or not.
That's maybe, would that say kind of postmodernism? I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think you know what you're talking about.
There's a variety of styles, but you know, one of the styles that's coming back, say, in New York City, is a kind of neo Art Deco that's consistent with the Gotham aesthetic in general. So I think there's a lot going on aesthetically right now. I don't know that the style that you were describing is particularly Promethean. No, and I think you're right that it's concealing power in a way that is perhaps.
Silicon Valley is kind of the best. I think New York City still, even though with all the problems and all the negative aspects, New York still captures like a Promethean aesthetic. But I think the perfect example is like Silicon Valley, how it's a seat of economic and political power. But you go there and it's just like suburban office parks. Like that's like the best example of how it does conceal power.
You know, that's not incidental either, because what I was going to say is that, you know, you described it as concealing power. Well, in the lightness of its structures, right, and its construction, it conceals power. Well, it conceals power in the same way that that late tech-driven capitalism conceals power, right? So all these tech companies, Google and Facebook and so on and so forth, they conceal the degree of coercive control they have over society. In a way, the machinations that they employ in order to advance their business model are concealing power in the same way as these architectural structures are, right? So on the face of it, they seem unimposing, but really they are exercising power in a more coercive way than anyone else has to date. And so, it's not surprising that kind of aesthetic would dominate in Silicon Valley, which is the nerve center of this kind of, really disingenuous, coercive control that attempts to present itself as liberation, but really is, the most insidious form of totalitarianism.
Like, I don't really want to get into Trump's politics, but a lot of neoliberal types, they hated like the aesthetic symbolism of Trump Tower, which was obviously very 80s and kind of the polar opposite of that, very glitzy.
I don't want to get into Trump and whatever, but I mean, I happen to like Trump Tower kind of, you know, being, look, it might be my sentimentalism as a New Yorker. I mean, I was there when it opened up back in the 80s, and it's an impressive structure when you stand inside the atrium, you know, sure, it's glitzy, but it's an impressive architectural structure, and
it does have an archaic futurist quality, like almost.
I agree.
Well, almost maybe, I'm not sure if you'd compare it, maybe kind of like a Mayan temple, like sort of a hodgepodge of different ancient genres, in the same way Art Deco was influenced by Mayan, Aztec, and various other Egyptian too.
Yeah, I agree. It's an interesting building in New York. Yeah.
And with the philosophy behind science, Prometheism and Prometheus offering technological scientific empowerment to release the full creative potential and defining the limitations of technological progress, and versus the kind of concept of mechanic reductionism. But I guess the main question I'll ask is, should we distinguish science from other technology, and then is the philosophical framework behind the aesthetic component of creativity, do you see it as separate from technological progress, or should be thought of as having the same foundation?
It should be thought of as having the same foundation. I underline throughout my various writings, beginning even in Prometheus and Atlas, actually especially in Prometheus and Atlas, I underline the fact that the Greek concept of techne is the root of both technology and art in the sense of fine art. It's a conception of craft that yields both technology and also fine art. And I think that we should retrieve the Renaissance man ideal of the artist innovator, which you saw, you know, in people like Nikola Tesla in the 20th century. And so that's what I would say about the relationship between the aesthetic and the technological. And then in terms of science and technology, you know, as I've argued consistently from Prometheus and Atlas onwards, science is a model-building enterprise that is fundamentally technological in nature. It's not that theoretical science yields technology as a byproduct. Science is a fundamentally technological enterprise. Theoretical frameworks are produced by techne for the sake of furthering techne. And so, no, I don't think you can separate science from technology. I talk about it as an integrated phenomenon.
Technology from arts and the aesthetic component, you view that as one and the same too?
Yes. It's all techne. It's all craft. And so this is the gift that Prometheus brought to humanity, right? You know, in that quote from Aeschylus that's inscribed over the statue of Prometheus at Rockefeller Center, it talks about how Prometheus brought techne to man as a gift that was to foster human empowerment and as a means to mighty ends, quote unquote. So the gift of Prometheus is not just, as some people assume, the gift of technological science. It's also the fire that the spark that kindles artistic creativity. So Prometheus is also the progenitor of creativity in the arts.
Yeah, I have a question. I mean, from what I'm understanding is that one of the big main difference in Prometheism and from what Roman said before about Promethean or that is that, well, Prometheus has given the gift to humanity, you know, to go forward in that kind of future transhumanism. In a way, in the physical world, everybody's, especially in America, is caught up with liberalism. And that is to say, you know, this neoliberal capitalism, go out, you're on your own, autonomize individualism. It seems that many people, if you didn't know about, you know, the Prometheus Manifesto, that they'll just translate this kind of transhumanism as, you know, do it yourself, you know, liberalism, and then it gives leeway to chaos and destruction. So in a way, what would you say is like kind of that big divide, if you were telling anyone, between liberalism versus American liberalism in particular versus Prometheism?
Right. You know, Roman had said that one other major difference between his standpoint and mine is that, you know, I'm, by embracing the singularity in the way that I am, I'm calling for the destruction or the transformation of all major institutions. And he said this is basically calling for a communist revolution, not a right-wing transhumanism. But, you know, in differentiating himself from right-wing conservatives and embracing the idea of the new man, Roman calls for ending the left's monopoly on the future. And he even says that the right has to become progressive, quote-unquote progressive. How does he envision singularity-level technologies transforming us in ways that make the future substantively different from the past and that involve tangible evolutionary progress if all of the major institutions of extant human society remain intact? I mean, in what sense is he embracing the idea of revolution and the idea of evolution? In Prometheism, I talk about evolutionary revolution, the R, you know, parentheses evolution. That the spectral revolution is evolutionary. And so if we're to embrace the singularity, clearly it means a transformation of some of the fundamental institutions of human society. And so to answer your question, this is, you know, one of the things that makes Prometheism very different from liberalism. Because basically, you know, liberal capitalism has not ultimately altered the fundamental structures of human society. I mean, even, like, to the extent that, let's say, there's been gay liberation or whatever as a result of liberal capitalism, you notice, looking at, you know, the, I don't know, gay rights struggle or something over the course of decades since the 1960s, that people who initially were very radical in their aspiration to transform society wound up basically just wanting to replicate the nuclear family structure through, you know, gay marriage and the adoption of children in the context of a capitalist economy. And so actually they're conforming to, you know, extant structures of human social organization. And capitalism seems to do that. I mean, it's actually less of a revolutionary force, perhaps, than Marx believed that it was. It seems that, you know, the market economy only reaffirms the types of structures that have defined human society going back to antiquity, at least in the West. And so, you know, I'm suggesting that if we embrace the singularity, of course, we do have to embrace it in a way that preserves human individuality and that doesn't, you know, turn us into something like the Borg. And that's one of the major concerns of Prometheism. But at the same time, embracing the various possibilities of the technological singularity would mean overcoming the limitations of various established forms of human social organization. And, you know, to the extent that Roman doesn't agree with that, I think that he remains a conservative. And so, sure, he wants to use, you know, emerging biotechnologies maybe to raise the IQ of the population or something like that. But, I mean, these are very limited, controlled uses of potentially singularity-level technologies. And I don't think that they are consistent with thinking of the singularity in Promethean terms. And let me just add in conclusion to that point that, you know, there's something to be said for his saying, I'm calling for a communist revolution. I'm not a communist. But as I've said in other conversations with the two of you and in other contexts, but I think especially in previous conversations that we've had together, my thought is as far to the left as it is to the right. And you know, in response to his insistence that no, left and right are, you know, fundamentally distinct orientations, I would say no. You know, he's wrong to reject Esfandiari's notion that we should replace the left-right dichotomy with a you know, downwinger versus upwinger dichotomy. I think Esfandiari was right on, and that, you know, the real distinction should be between people who are regressive and people who are progressive. And there's elements of that progressive orientation that are actually very much in line with certain right-wing political forms of the past. And there are other elements that converge with aspects of communism.
I want to get into your platform where it demonstrates that, but with the morality and ethics of Prometheism, there's no tolerance for this kind of punitive moral outrage of like what we're seeing with woke culture, and I'm sure this would apply to traditionalist morality as well, but what would you say is the overall moral and ethical foundation of Prometheism? So you're opposed to punitive moral outrage, like what we're seeing, but would there be some kind of moral code or foundation? It's definitely not nihilism.
Moral, yeah, look, the moral outrage of groups like BLM and other social justice warriors is you know, entirely based on what Nietzsche calls ressentiment. It's a kind of vengeful resentment that wants to just tear everything down without having any conception of what to replace it with, let alone, you know, what to replace it with that would be superior to the existing structures. And by superior, I don't mean, as judged by some objective metric. I mean superior in the sense of expanding the realm of possibilities and empowering people by inspiring them. I don't see these people, the social justice warriors, as offering anything like that. All they want to do is tear down, you know, the monuments the monuments that enshrine the heritage of our existing civilization without any conception of what to replace it with. And so the Promethean orientation toward, you know, social development is an aim to maximize human empowerment and the cultivation of the human potential and expression of the human potential, right? So, yeah, let me leave it at that, and then see, you know, where you want to go from there, if you want to get into more detail about that.
Yeah, like the moral foundation, then also making a kind of a comparison, Prometheism as a comparison to a religion, and then if so, like, is there a strong spiritual component, or is it purely worldly, focused on this world with less of a concern of an afterlife or spiritual realm? And then we've touched upon this before, but do you believe Christianity can coexist with Prometheism, or could there be a Christian Prometheism under the same umbrella, or are these philosophical and theological divergences that great? I guess kind of the example, on a side note, that if Prometheism were to take off, they would share the same common adversary as conservative Christians. So your overall thoughts on those theological divergences?
Yeah, no, I don't think we have a common adversary. You know, it's not always the case that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That's a kind of retarded political logic in a lot of cases. So I do not think that conservative Christians in the South of the United States, for example, have any common cause with Prometheus. No, they don't. But to answer your deeper question, one of the problems with liberalism is that it doesn't recognize that it is a definite ethos. Okay, so when liberals affirm something like freedom of religion unconditionally, and you see this both in the United States Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, and you also see it in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that the United Nations came up with at the end of the Second World War. This liberal affirmation of unqualified freedom of religion is something that renders liberalism fundamentally incoherent. There are a number of other things that render liberalism incoherent, but that's a major one, okay? Because if you give leeway to people who believe in religions that are radically illiberal, and religions that, if they become demographically dominant, even as the religion of substantive minorities of a population, are going to threaten the social fabric and the political constitution of liberal states, then you are basically destroying yourself. Okay, and this is a very dangerous form of incoherence that goes to the core of liberalism. And so one way in which Prometheism is different from liberalism, with respect to the question of religion and morality, quote unquote, as you were framing it, is that at the heart of my Prometheus platform is the idea that we need to affirm a definite ethos as the basis for sociopolitical order. So civil liberties, yes. I mean, you know, there could be nothing more important than the protection of freedom of thought, freedom of conscience, freedom not just of the press, but of all forms of expression for the individual. But you cannot have freedom of religion. The fundamental values of a society that wants to preserve liberty for the individual have to be explicitly affirmed. And so you cannot give liberty to people who are enemies of liberty. So this means that there is no place.
I get what you're saying, but that's actually what the woke left is saying. They'll say that because racist, like white supremacists, want to oppress others, then that's justification for removing their liberties.
Okay, when did these woke leftist retards ever try to take away rights from Muslims? Have you seen these woke leftist retards go into black churches and tell conservative black Christians they can't be Christian? Okay, so I'm not even interested. I mean, these people are, look, if they had some consistency in their approach, that would be one thing. But clearly, they are not really motivated by eliminating the enemies of liberty. I don't give them any credence when they say, okay, we're anti-racist because racists are enemies of individual liberty or of, you know, the rights of the individual. I don't buy it, because actually, you know, Muslims, conservative Muslims and conservative Christians, let's say in the United States, not to mention Europe, but certainly in the United States, these conservative religious groups are a far greater threat to individual liberty than any putative white supremacists, quote unquote. So, yeah, that's I'm calling bullshit on that discourse of theirs.
As far as the essay of the task of the philosopher, what are your thoughts on the traditional concept that there is a perennial wisdom that is timeless? Or do you see the role of the philosopher as playing a role? I don't know if it would be accurate to describe them as a priest caste, but basically having a role of revealing the secrets of the universe. So I guess the key point is perennial wisdom versus philosophy that's constantly evolving with each generation.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the latter is my position. And, you know, I've belabored this in other conversations and I've written an entire essay on it called Against Perennial Philosophy, which is in Lovers of Sophia. So I actually don't think that perennial philosophy is philosophy at all. I don't think this idea of Sophia Perennis or the eternal tradition, the primordial tradition, capital T, this is a form of theology. It's not philosophy. It's anti-philosophical because it, you know, presupposes that there was always a self-same, unchanging wisdom and body of knowledge, which, you know, is only to be rediscovered or uncovered or excavated by sages throughout the course of history. And, you know, what philosophy really begins in is a sense of wonder and a questioning with respect to the cosmos and with respect to the depths of the psyche. And so this questioning spirit of philosophy is, fundamentally negated by a commitment to that idea of, primordial tradition and of a so-called, eternal wisdom. So, yeah, I think that, philosophy is actually a radically Promethean enterprise, and that Karl Marx was quite right when he called Prometheus the, patron saint and sort of patriarch of philosophy, that Prometheus was the first philosopher, which not incidentally is something that Heidegger agreed with Marx on. Heidegger also said, I believe in his rectoral address, that Prometheus was the first philosopher. In other words, the prototype or archetype of the philosopher.
And then beyond the philosophy is the foundation, but then you take that further and put forth a political platform on a lot of a wide range of issues from science to technology, policy to education, civil liberties, socioeconomic policy, criminal justice, artificial intelligence, and defense policy. Can you talk about this political platform, and would you say that it's a kind of like third position, radical centrism, or syndicalism with...
Yeah, it's certainly not centrist. Let me make this point before I say anything else, is that I am not a centrist.
Just to clarify, radical centrism is a different...
Well, let's put it this way, yeah, but people are going to get confused terminology. And it's very great that you said that, because it's a good opportunity to clarify this. There is a position that's neither left nor right, which is between left and right. That's centrism. There's another place on the political spectrum. If you consider the political spectrum a circle rather than a line, right? A circle that, like an Ouroboros.
So like a globe rather than, there's a really simplistic, Nolan chart, which is superficial, and I would disregard that. But then there's more the view of a political compass as a globe.
Yeah. So in that compass of the political spectrum, there is a position between left and right that is a centrist position. And then there's somewhere, that's like the political establishment in the United States, where ultimately, John McCain and Hillary Clinton belong to the same political ideology. It's neither right wing nor left wing. It's some centrist, amalgamation. I am 180 degrees opposite to that position. In other words, at a place where the most radical left converges with the radical right, a place that is to the right of Mussolini and to the left of Marx. That's where my Prometheism is politically, if you were to ask me. And, you know, actually, I'm not alone in being in that place. I'd say if you look at Plato's political philosophy carefully, he was one of the first people to try to occupy that position. And then, you know, if you want to get into the Prometheus political platform, the first thing that I have to clarify is that I don't have, a Prometheus platform laid out. What I published on Prometheism is a piece called Towards a Prometheus Platform. And that towards is very important. There is as yet no fixed, clearly determined Prometheus political platform. But I sketched out some ideas on the way to something like a Prometheus political platform. And, you know, this can be found on Prometheism.com. And it lays out some ideas with respect to, you know, science and technology, as you said, educational policy, civil liberties, socioeconomic policies, criminal justice, and security, intelligence, and defense. And, you know, I can touch on some of the specific points there if you'd like. But again, to belabor the point, this is not a fixed platform. It's a sketching out of some preliminary ideas on the way toward a platform.
So this does relate to the kind of belief in the potential of the average citizen versus the capacity to exercise their freedom and reach their full potential. But have you thought about putting forth a kind of like PragerU type video for normies, like explaining Prometheism in layman's term, or are you going for a more elite audience? And that point, like relating to the concept of elitism versus the potential of the average person.
Okay. So we will do that. I have no doubt that at some point, probably in the not too distant future, we will translate the message of this movement into terms that can be more widely disseminated. And, you know, in a kind of, in a style that's accessible and that, you know, can hold the attention span and kindle the interest of a larger percentage of the population. But we're not at that stage yet, okay? So I think this movement, could be characterized as elitist, not in any kind of financial sense, but in the sense, legitimately characterized as elitist in the sense that it's a movement that's being built from the top down. No question about that. This is not a ground-up movement. This is a top-down movement. And my primary objective is to bring together a group of people that could act as guardians in a Platonic sense of this movement and the achievement of its objectives over the long run. So my first target audience are people who will understand this way of thinking in its full complexity. And then after that, we can begin to translate this program in terms that are more, widely accessible. But I have to say, as a caveat to that, that I do not envision Prometheism ever being a mass movement in the sense of populist politics. In fact, I think I've leveled a very scathing and cogent critique of democracy and of any kind of populism. Both liberal democracy and social democracy of the kind that, you know, communists sometimes advocate. I have leveled a critique at that kind of populism throughout the course of my philosophical writings, especially in my book World State of Emergency. And so I think that, you know, one of our aims should be to eradicate populism in all forms in the political sphere, and to replace it with a kind of political structure that is meritocratic and not technocratic in an instrumentalist sense, but that rewards technical competence and visionary insight. That's the kind of political system we need. And so, you know, it would not be consistent with the political philosophy of Prometheism to engage in populist politics. And so that's by way of, again, you know, more fully answering your question. Yeah, sure, we will translate these ideas into terms that are going to be more easily understandable by a larger segment of the population. But that is never going to be the numerical majority of the population, and this is never going to be a mass movement. And quite frankly, I mean, I will tell you, I don't think there's hope for the majority of the population. I don't think so. We are headed into an evolutionary bottleneck. There are various crises attendant to the advent of the technological singularity, which will demand an evolutionary leap from humanity. And the vast majority of people are not going to be able to make that evolutionary leap. The new form of human society will be constituted from out of a dedicated minority. That minority is going to include a lot of people who presently, would not be able to wrap their minds around the full complexity of the concepts that I've set forth in various of my writings. So yes, they need those concepts, those ideas need to be translated into a more easily understandable form. But it's not just a question of, intellectual understanding. The problem is that the majority of people, not just in our society, but globally, the majority of people don't have the spirit that would be required for them to embrace the aims of our movement. I mean, this is why, what I call Olympian, tyrannical political structures have prevailed over the course of human history, because most people want to be slaves. They don't want to admit that to themselves, but most people are, Nietzsche was quite right to understand that most people are herd animals, and they want to be told what to do. They don't want to have to consult their conscience and, live from out of their own spiritual resources, right? And in a way where they're determining the course of their own lives. They're extremely conformist, and they are not spiritually aligned with, the aims of Prometheism. And so, yeah, I will never make an attempt to sacrifice the ideals and the fundamental ideas of this movement in order to appeal to mass man. Rather, mass man has to go so that we can shape the future.
Well, I mean, from understanding where you're coming from, I feel like ultimately, besides, isolating liberalisms from itself, where the country is headed to, or at least the world, is a paternal system versus the free will of the individual. And your referencing of Platonism and of guardians seem to me like a paternal force, and as well that populism could be that, people trying to search for that paternalism. And then again, there's the hostility of this Chinese Confucius paternalism that invades over people's lives. So how would, in Prometheism, is there a complete balance of the paternal, or is it this omnipotent kind of paternalism that's actually required and needed in order for people to go forward?
Right. The question is, who's your daddy? That's the fundamental question, right? Prometheus is the father of humanity, not Zeus. Prometheus is the engineer of man. And we were subsequently stolen away by Zeus and subjected, to enslavement and, sadistic manipulation. So the guardians that I envision along the lines of, what Plato proposed as the ideal society, the guardians that I envision as the political class of a Prometheist order would be the best kind of parent who wants to foster the full development of their child's potential. And the furthest thing from the kind of paternalism that you see in a figure like Zeus or Jehovah. So you have the parent who is extremely controlling, who is jealous of their children, does not want to be upstaged by their children, and so keeps their children down and holds them back from fulfilling their potential. And on the other hand, you have the kind of parent who wants their child to become greater than they are, and who exercises authority and control only to the extent that it's protecting the child in ways that allow the child to fully develop. Okay, and so that's the conception of the guardian class that I have. It comes back to how you conceive of proper parenthood, And it comes back to the recognition that, you know, our true father is Prometheus and not Zeus or Jehovah.
And yeah, this kind of goes back to the previous point that we made on the last podcast. Like, all these populists online who are hoping for someone like Tucker Carlson or Tulsi Gabbard, or let alone Trump again in 2024, Ron DeSantis, for president. And it kind of goes back to the previous point we made, like focusing more on creative endeavors and outside of politics, such as art, culture, and technology. So that kind of does seem to be where we are as far as like the failure of populism. Jason Giorgiani, do you have any other points you want to make, or do you have any upcoming projects with Prometheism that you want to plug?
I'll just say in conclusion, in response to the point that you just made, that I agree with you. Look, if Trump had won in 2020, well, actually, Trump did win in 2020 and they stole the election. Okay, but, you know, if we had had a second term of Trump, all that would have done would be to buy us time, right? The reason I supported Trump in the 2020 election, despite all of the problems that I had with him and the scathing criticisms of him that I voiced over the course of, you know, the 4 years of his presidency, was that it would have bought us some time. Trump was never the solution. And you know, Tulsi Gabbard in 2020, had Tulsi Gabbard become the Democratic candidate, as everyone who knows, who follows my, you know, various statements, you know, and, you know, over the years, I was a strong backer of Tulsi Gabbard and certainly would have voted for Tulsi Gabbard over Donald Trump had she secured the Democratic nomination. That having been said, Tulsi Gabbard is a Hare Krishna, you know, who in the end will wind up affirming a traditionalist, basically perennialist world order. So I never was under any illusion that Tulsi Gabbard was the solution. But again, she would have bought us some time. At this point, you know, with the deep state having seized total control of America over the course of the next at least 4 years, and possibly, I think, over two terms of Kamala Harris that might follow the Biden presidency, we are now on on the most radical, revolutionary trajectory possible. I don't think we should be looking for any form of compromise with the establishment. I think that people who are interested in, you know, Trump 2024, Tucker Carlson, like, you know, I enjoy him as a journalist. At least we get some semblance of the truth of what's going on from journalists like Tucker Carlson. But I mean, forget it. If you think that man's going to save America somehow and redeem the Republic, forget about it. You're delusional. It's over. It's over. We are headed toward a radical revolution at this point. And we need to start thinking about what kind of order should replace the United States, because this system will collapse. It's only a matter of time. So we should be thinking about the alternative structure that will replace the United States and that has a chance at being able to successfully struggle with the prospect of Chinese hegemony. So that's what I would say in conclusion. As for, you know, any projects that I have, underway, right now the focus of my work is a book on Close Encounters, a dedicated study of Close Encounters that I hope to have done certainly before the end of the year.
Jason Reza Giorgiani, great show. Thanks for being on, and also thanks, Francis Nally.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure.
It's been nice, guys. Talk to you then.
Take care. Bye-bye.